Welcome to Real Stories, a show that has honest conversations from the heart. I invite you to sit back, relax, and allow our guests to speak their truth.
Hello, I'm Taylor, the communication doctor, and welcome to Real Stories. I just want to say, I come from a family where people didn't always speak their truth. And I think it's so important to speak their truth. And every day I meet people who, because of society, are just walking with that facade because they feel that it is the way to be. And in Real Stories, I want people to know the real story behind the facade. And that is why I do what I do.
Hello, this is Real Stories, and I am your host, Taylor the Communication Doctor. And today on my show, I have Nicola Johnson. And Nicola is the founder member in Burt's HR company. Lovely to have you on the show today, Nicola.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here on this lovely day.
Oh, and it is a beautiful day today. The sun is shining today, so it's a good day to have a conversation. Mind you, any day is a good day to have a conversation, mind. So I just want to start off by you just telling me a little bit about your HR company, because you are a founder member of Birch Company. And I know from the time that I've known you that you are a powerhouse, a change maker, and you really do feel really strongly about how people are treated within the workplace. So do you want to tell me a little bit about why HR and why Birch HR?
Yeah, so Birch HR was set up between myself and Samantha Hulson in 2016. And what we wanted to do was to provide our clients, and our core client is education, with really good and strong and solution-focused HR to help not only the school to have the right people working in the school, but actually to help those people in school to know that they are being treated properly. So we do, you know, obviously there are times when we have to do that kind of HR, which is, you know, the disciplines and the grievances and moving people on. But the other thing that we do is we empower leaders and middle leaders in school to teach them how to manage properly. You know, the amount of times we're told that as head teachers, we're not taught this. We're not taught about managing staff and managing difficult conversations. So we actually invest a lot of time in working with those middle leaders and leaders to empower them to manage people properly, to try and avoid, you know, punitive and draconian processes that are often in place when it comes to HR and disciplinary procedures. And we absolutely believe that, you know, to take the red tape away, to try and take away processes and just speak to people like they are human beings and not just numbers. So that's where we're coming from. And we work with all kinds of schools. We work with our trade union partners, and we work with diocesans, and we work with anybody who needs our help to help them get the right people in their schools.
You know what, it's just so powerful. And even as you just talking there, I can see your strength and I can feel your power in terms of, you know, you being determined. And what I love is the fact that you are coming from the educational perspective, and me coming from the educational background, I feel it's just so important to have HR companies like yourself that are addressing these issues, because some of the problems are with bullying and poor leadership within schools. And it, you know, it's like with anything in a company, when you have that no empathy and poor leadership, it can affect every level, because if the top is not clear, then it affects every level. And just moving on from that, I just want to ask you a little bit about, you know, how things have been going with regards to the whole diversity and inclusion, and if that's kind of been an issue. Because I remember when we did actually speak on a post where I think I was speaking quite openly about my parents coming over around the Windrush generation, and there would be no dogs, no Irish, no black signs on the walls when they came to the country. And I remember you responding and with regards to the Irish experience. And I found that's quite interesting in terms of your ancestry and where you're coming from. And I suppose what I'm asking you is, I'd like you to tell me a little bit more about where that kind of comes from, where that kind of that need for equality and diversity, you know, where that comes from, what your experience of that has been.
Ooh, I feel a little bit of a cheat by saying that's my experience, because I think I've learned that from listening to my grandparents who came to Manchester in the 1950s. At the same time, they were seeing those signs, no black, no Irish, no dogs. And they did keep away. And they had children then who, you know, my father and his brothers and sisters, who to all intents and purposes were accepted as British people because they looked like British people. And then their grandchildren come along and here I am, you know, and I'm accepted as a British person because I look like a British person. And I just think that it's really sad that anybody who has grandparents and parents who came to this country who just happen to have the wrong skin colour are not accepted when actually they're as British as I am. So, you know, sometimes I think I'm incredibly lucky. You know, aren't I lucky that my grandparents came from a country where you looked British and you looked the same as people here, when actually I'm no different to people who came here, whose parents and grandparents came here from India, from Africa, from the Caribbean. And it's just incredibly sad that people feel that I don't know how they feel. I think they just see a difference rather than similarities.
And coming from Birmingham, because Birmingham's quite a diverse place, isn't it? And coming from Birmingham, yeah, and having to deal with education and HR, have you come across any of these kinds of problems with diversity and inclusion? Are you seeing enough of that within the educational system in the Midlands?
The education system, I wouldn't say that it's necessarily a system. I think that a lot of our schools are in, you know, they're in very local areas and localised areas. So the schools are very much reflective of the community around them. So, you know, I can be in a school where 97-98% of the children in school are Muslim children because it's in a Muslim area, and then you can drive 10 minutes up the road and you'll be in a Catholic school and all the children are Roman Catholic, because, you know, that's the Catholic schools can have that as their criteria for an intake. So it's almost like little micro communities that you go through from one to the other. I actually come across more of the diversity issues in schools outside of the city, because there are, you know, rather than it being all of the children from a very small area coming together, especially in the rural areas, you get a lot of people coming from quite some distance, and it's in those situations that we do find more of the diversity challenges, and not just amongst the, I obviously don't get involved very much with the children, but with the amongst the staff groups, because the staff group has to be more diverse and more accepting of different cultures and different behaviours.
That's what I was getting at. But when I asked that question, I was referring to leadership. I wasn't referring to the children, because I think that's
it's important. But even the staff in schools tend to be, particularly in the small primaries, tend to be reflective of the local area, because, you know, teaching staff are a small proportion really of staff, yeah, in school. You've got your teaching assistants, you've got your part-time lunchtime supervisors who tend to be local and more closely local to the school. And so it is in those schools that have more of a travel to that you have clashes of culture.
Yeah, yeah. Now that's quite interesting, because I do feel that sometimes if there's I, even with teaching myself, sometimes I'd go to a school, especially more primary schools because they're smaller rather than secondary, and they might be reflective within the TAs but not within the teaching staff. And I feel that's an issue really, because you do need more diversity within the teaching staff, that reflection in terms of that hierarchy that is within. I do see schools as system, I see them as institutions, so there is, yeah. So I suppose I'm looking at it from a different perspective to see how that also all kind of marry together. But just going back, because coming back to you actually, I just wanted to kind of just touch on that, because it was quite, I found it quite interesting. But just coming back to you, Nicola, and I know that you've had some challenges in your life, and I just want you to maybe share with us some of the challenges that you've had to experience, just through life, really, you know?
But I don't think, well, I've had quite a few challenges. I don't think you realise you're having challenges when you're a child. You don't realise that things are a little bit different. But, you know, even though I live in Birmingham now, I grew up in Stafford, which is quite a bit, it's a bit of a boring market town, really, where everybody knows everybody else, but there isn't work there. And I grew up in a Catholic community with a single parent. My parents did divorce when I was a teenager, and that, so I didn't see that much of Dad. He moved back to Manchester, so we were raised mainly by Mum, but Mum had her issues with alcohol, so there was a lot of me looking after my youngest sister. And I never really saw that as a problem until you look back on it, until you become part of a family yourself, I think. And then you think, oh, actually, that wasn't quite normal, was it? So so there's been some challenges there. But, you know, actually, me and my brother and my sister are all very, very strong people as a result, I think, in the face of how we've been, how our upbringing was. Since... I was a single parent myself. I am moved on in my relationship now. But, you know, after I had my son, he was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis at 3 weeks old. And probably that created the beginning of the end of my marriage. Then it was just too much for George's dad, I think, to accept and to deal with. He's probably a better dad now than he was when we were together, because, you know, he has to have his son and deal with that side of things without trying to avoid. You know, I think when you're in a relationship, you realise, you look back and you think, actually, no wonder he was out so much. He was avoiding me. But now he sees George and he has George on his own. So he is a much better. Things are working there now. But I think the most difficult thing I've had to face was when... After George was diagnosed with CF, he had a really difficult first year. Very, very poorly little boy who only managed to beat the 10-pound barrier when he was 5 months old after quite a lot of surgeries. When he was, I think when he was about 4 years old, we got the news that a new drug was on its way. And it's called a precision medication for cystic fibrosis. And it goes some way to correct the cell. So cystic fibrosis itself is a disease that's genetic, and it means that all the mucus in your body, the cells that produce the mucus in the body, they don't really work properly. So it results in the mucus being sticky and thick, a little bit like glue. So that means that it clogs up in your lungs and it clogs your pancreas and your digestive system, and it creates all kinds of problems there. And mainly the problems are around the lung function and repeated chest infections. That can come with having that and the lung damage and the reduced lung function. So when George was about four, it was right, this new drug's coming, you know, it's come out, it's in America, and it goes some way to correct the cell, and it makes the mucus thinner and stopping those infections. It's not perfect, but it's going to be, what it can do is really slow down the decline. So instead of his life expectancy being, at the time it was in sort of late 30s, it could be, you know, in his 50s, which is just, it was absolutely brilliant. Mm. And then it got European license in 2015, in November 2015. I remember exactly a week before my birthday, I read it. I was like, this is brilliant. This has got to happen. And we were waiting. And then what ensued was absolutely unimaginable, that I became a drugs campaigner, because the NHS and Vertex, which is the American pharmaceutical company, could not reach a deal on price.
Oh.
And yeah, so Vertex wanted something like £105,000 per person per year for this drug. Wow. Now, this drug would help half the people with CF in the UK, because it was for the more common genetic mutations, which thankfully George has a common genetic mutation. So it would have impacted half. So about 4,000, 5,000 people across the UK would have benefited from this drug. So, you know, it doesn't take much maths to realise how expensive that is. So we found ourselves, you know, that you find yourself actually in despair that this is happening. And then you're still thinking, well, they'll reach a deal soon. They'll reach a deal. And then it went on. And then we protested outside of Number 10. And there was a lady there who had older kids who were, you know, in end of life care, and she said, they're making us beg for these drugs. And that's what it felt like. But for all that time, we felt, I'm speaking on behalf of the CF community here, but I felt demeaned. I felt like they were putting a price tag on my son's life. I felt angry all the time, you know, that every day a little bit of lung function is taken away, a little bit of pancreatic function is taken away, and these people had the power in their hands and they wouldn't reach a deal over money. Wow. So, yeah. So we fought and we fought.
It's disgusting. No, as you tell me this story, I just think it's so disgusting, isn't it, really, you know? But that's pharmaceutical companies for you, isn't it, really? That it's all about money. It's not, you know, they're not thinking about your son or thinking about all people like yourself who get with children with cystic fibrosis.
That's the frustration, though, isn't it? Yeah. Because they are thinking about it. Because when a scientist comes up with this, they are thinking about my son, not him, but the people with CF. We can help these hundreds of thousands of people across the globe. Look at what we've done.
Yeah, they offer, but the money, the pharmaceuticals get in the way. And
and you know what? We were very careful as a campaign group not to blame one side or the other, because we wanted them to come with us on our journey and understand why we were so angry. Okay. And to this day, I don't know who was to blame. Was it our government not spending enough money? Was it Vertex? Likelihood is it's somewhere in the middle.
Yes. Okay. So not enough evidence to say that's a very nice way of looking at it, really, I suppose, because you haven't got all the evidence yet, so you don't know if it's Vertex or if it is the government. And like you say, rather than blame someone, I mean, it's just a horrible story.
And we'd write to our MPs, and our MPs would write back to us and say, this isn't a decision for me, this is a decision for NICE. And NICE were saying that the benefits weren't good enough, because the NICE system of saying whether a drug is worth the money is based on improvement. And of course, this drug didn't improve our children. It stabilized them.
Yeah.
So, you know, so the points system isn't working for this precision group of medication. So we found ourselves kind of fighting NICE, fighting the government, fighting NHS England, fighting Vertex. And it was just, you know, the first thing you do every morning was check for an update. When's the next discussion? When's the next meeting? And then you'd be on tenterhooks. What's the outcome? And the outcome would be, for 4 long years, we haven't reached a deal. We can't reach a deal. We're not even close.
Wow.
We did, one of the national newspapers did take on the cause as well, and they ran over 100 stories on this to try and get behind us as a community. It took a while. It took about 2.5 years to get that kind of national profile, because, you know, before then we'd be on local news and that sort of thing, but nationally it took a long time, because people from the CF community, the people with CF, can't meet. So it was us as parents having to do this campaigning, so people with cystic fibrosis couldn't get as involved physically, being outside Westminster with their placards. It was all down to somebody doing it on their behalf. And we are a relatively small group. It's a rare disease, but it's the most common rare disease in the UK. So we fall between that being rare enough so that an expensive drug, we can afford it because it's only a small group of people, to being not rare enough, if you know what I mean.
So this drug came out 2015, and we're now in 2020.
Yeah, so the drug was licensed in Europe in 2015. It was available in the USA before then. Yeah.
So what's the update now? We're now in 2020.
Yeah, so I in October 2019, a deal was reached for two drugs called Orkambi and Symkevi, and they are the stabilising drugs that I talked about.
Yeah.
And it came out of the blue. That came on, the journalist at the national paper actually informed the group, and then Matt Hancock announced it. So the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care announced it as well. And I cannot tell you the tears I cried that day. Right. And I had to go out to a meeting to a school, and I was driving through Handsworth, which is an area.
Birmingham.
I was driving through Handsworth, and there's one long straight road. And going to, I already had to phone the school to say I was going to be late, which I hate being late, so I'm going to be late. And I said, Nicola, we know, we've seen it on the news. So they knew already.
Aww.
And as I was driving down this road to school, I just cheered in my car. And I was like, yes, all the way to, and I was, and I'm trying to still be a consummate professional when I turned up at the school. Obviously.
But you were just like relief almost. It must have felt like,
it was almost primal, the relief of, my, after all of this, my son is going to be okay.
Mm.
You know, mm. it's, so he's, so we'd got the deal for those, but a new drug was had just been released in the States, and that's the triple combination. Now, where we'd fought, we'd hoped that the government were going to do a pipeline deal. So in Ireland, they've done a pipeline deal that says, we'll have these drugs now. When the next ones come along, which are going to be absolutely even better, we'll have those as well. So we didn't do the pipeline for whatever reason, obviously financial, but that wasn't agreed. And then on, so you kind of park it, you think, okay, well, we've got what we need for now. Thinking selfishly, George is young. We've got time. We've got time to have another battle and fight for those drugs. Let's get these ones in him. Let's bottle him at the 80% lung function that he's at and just keep doing what we're doing. Because he's having these, he started on Orkambi in January and he still has to do all of his other treatments, which is his physio and his nebulizer and all of the other tablets he has to take every time he eats. So we're still doing all of that and waiting patiently. And then on Friday the 26th of June, the European Medical Association licensed the triple combination. Now, there are people I know, adults, who've had this triple combination on compassionate grounds, and their lung function has gone from being low enough for them to have the drug on compassionate grounds, potentially needing a transplant, around 30%, up to 80% lung function.
Wow.
In 3 or 4 months. So not only, this isn't a stabilizer, this is a, we will improve you drug. So, and this is the kind of drug that if taken before too much damage is done, so maybe somebody like George, their CF regime could be replaced with 3 tablets a day.
Wow.
For the rest of his, for the rest of his life.
Yeah. And in comparison the combination, the triple combination is the,
So that's the holy grail. It's the closest thing we've got, and probably the closest thing we'll ever get to a cure. And the better thing about that drug is that it helps 90% of people with cystic fibrosis, not just 50%. So we're talking 9,000 people in the UK are going to be eligible for this drug. So that is just fantastic. So the news dropped on Friday. The EMA, the European Medical Association, have licensed it.
Well, just this Friday gone.
And I felt sick. I felt sick, Tanya, because I thought, here we go again. How many years are we going to be battling for this drug again?
Yeah.
And I was honestly, and even talking to other parents in the group, we weren't happy. We were overwhelmed with, isn't this brilliant? We were feeling sick and I don't think I realized the toll that battle had taken on me. Having to go to London, watching the news every day, looking for updates, the anger every time you go to a hospital appointment and something out, lung function has dipped, or we're concerned about blood sugars, or we're concerned about liver function. What if you'd have had that drug, would this have happened? So not only are you a little bit upset and sad that this is happening to your child, but equally you're angry because you think somebody somewhere has the power to stop this. Yeah. And if I had to go through that again. Anyway, yesterday, this out of the blue, without any battle, obviously we scared them into submission last time, NHS England and Vertex have made the deal.
Oh, so, brilliant. Finally.
So,
finally, eh?
That's what the climax is. Wow. So obviously yesterday there was lots of tears in our house again.
Yeah, I understand. It's all that, you're carrying so much energy, aren't you? And you're, I suppose it's like people are moaning now with COVID because of all of the uncertainty and the unknown. But imagine with you, that's been like a majority of your child's life, where you've been waiting for this, this drug.
Imagine.
This unknown.
Only, you know,
I said, of it in 6 months and we're moaning. Most people are moaning with COVID, have a taste of not knowing what's going to happen. But,
I sit and wonder whether or not George is going to make it to his mid-20s without going on the lung transplant list.
Wow.
And I don't have to worry about that now.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Because he's young enough, he will have this drug when he's 12, hopefully before, if they do lower the age. But we know he'll have it when he's 12. He's almost 10.
Mm.
You know, I've done 10 years without him having a chest infection. We can push it for a little bit more.
Mm.
And he'll have these drugs. And for the first time since he was 3 weeks old when he was diagnosed, I can sit here there and go, he's going to have a normal life. You know, I'm going to have to be like a normal parent and have other things to worry about.
Constantly having to worry about whether or not he's going to have the drugs that help him to survive and live longer. That's incredible.
Wow. So, you know, I have massive issues with George's weight gain, and I'm sitting there going, just leave the salad and eat the chips, son, for heaven's sake, you know. And he has to have high salt in his diet. And so I'm one of those weird parents who will be pouring salt all over his food. Oh. I'm going to have to be one of those people who says, you can't have pudding if you don't eat your salad like a normal person. So it's going to be real. And actually, somebody said to me the other day, because George is really outgoing and he loves that little bit of difference about him for now. Mm. How is he going to feel being a normal person? And I think he might struggle with it, you know, but, you know, he's just going to have to. I'd rather him not be happy about being the same as everybody else and living till he's an old man.
So. Oh, that's his uniqueness, isn't it? And I remember seeing when you put a video up of him, he's got so much courage. He's so brave. He's such a lovely boy.
I think it comes with having a chronic health condition. He's had to explain how he's feeling to adults of all kinds. You know, you don't get the same doctor every time we go to the hospital. You know, he's had to keep explaining himself. It started off as a baby where they'd talk to me, and then he was a toddler and they'd try and talk to George, but he's really playing with the toys in the corner. But now they're talking to George and I'm playing with the toys in the corner in the hospital appointment.
Oh, bless you. Wow. Well, I'm glad in some ways. I'm happy for you that this week has been one of those weeks, and it happens to be a week that we're talking and the drugs are coming through, and there is light at the end of the tunnel, and you as a parent can relax, because I suppose as a parent you're never totally relaxed, are we?
No, but it's a different kind of relax, isn't it? I can focus on him being cheeky instead of, can you eat your dinner, and can we do this properly, and have you done your physio, and have you done your nebulizer, and can, you know, because when we get up in the morning, we're up for 2 hours before we go out doing treatments. So to think that there's a real possibility that, you know, it might not be eliminated, but it will be reduced as he gets older, is just fantastic. Can you imagine the parents of teenagers with CF, the struggles that they have to get them to do their treatment?
Well, that's why I'm doing this podcast today, because I mean, I didn't even know anything really about cystic fibrosis before speaking to you. And then you had the yellow, was it the other day? It was a yellow day, wasn't it? In celebration. So all of that is just, you know, because some things, if they're not at the forefront of the news and you don't know about them, and if you're not going through that experience, you have no clue. And I think it's just so important to have that awareness, because there's so much things going on in the world, and whether it is government or whether it is the pharmacy or Vertex or whatever, you know, that these things need to be brought to the news or brought out there so people can make changes and fight for what is right to help. Because as a human being, though, to help things push forward so your son, George, can have that longer life and a bit more kind of security, or for you, that kind of security of knowing that, you know, there is some normality there, even though he is unique and he is amazing, your son. But I suppose some sense of that, having a healthy, I suppose, not so much normality, maybe that's not the right word, but a healthy life, you know, or a healthier life than he currently has. So that's just amazing. So as I kind of pull this, because, you know, time has gone so quickly here, as I pull this to a close, Nicola, what's your vision for the future?
For people with CF or for people with...
Just for you, just for you from a personal level. What's your vision for the future?
Well,
you and your son, you know, is it moving to the Caribbean? I don't know.
Do you know what? You know, there's so much that you think, you know, you always think, I've always thought it'd be lovely to live on the Mediterranean when I've retired, and that, all those sorts of things about thinking about myself as I get older. I've not really done that since George was diagnosed. It's all been about him. Yeah. But now actually he is going to be independent. He's going to be independent of me. I can, you know, my sister was like, you're going to have to get a hobby, because if you're not doing these treatments, and if you're not doing the all of the protesting and the campaigning, what on earth are you going to do? And actually, you know, I haven't been to the gym since he was tiny. I haven't had the time. And, you know, that's normal single parents. That's what happens. But, you know, he's going to become more independent of me, and I can start to think about what I want to do now. And what I do want to do really is give back a little bit. I get asked probably on a weekly basis to be a governor of a school. you know, when he's maybe when he's at secondary school and he doesn't need me so much, I can start to do that and start to think about how I can give back now to some of those schools that have believed in and supported Birch HR from the start. You know, we wouldn't be here as an organisation. I wouldn't be earning money so that I can look after George the way he needs. The NHS won't provide certain equipment or can't. I can, you know, and I'm lucky that I can do that. And I'm doing that because when Sam and I set up Birch HR, a core group of schools believed in us and they gave us their business. So, you know, hopefully I'll be able to give something back.
That's so beautiful. No, that's amazing. And it's so lovely. It just says a lot about you as a person, as wanting to give back. And now you've got even that little bit more of your life and you're still wanting to give back. You're still wanting to help support the people that supported you. I think that's absolutely beautiful, Nicola. And maybe the Mediterranean will come in terms of a house in the Mediterranean maybe. Over time.
Yeah, but I'm of Irish descent, Tanya. I'll just get sunburned and want to come home.
Oh, bless you. But yeah, that made me laugh. But yes, of the Irish descent, I can hear you. I mean, I'm of West Indian descent, and sometimes when I went to last holiday, we were in Lanzarote, I couldn't take the heat, I tell you. So it's something when you're brought up in a country where you're so used to the different seasons, you just get so used to it. And sometimes when it's really hot, it's a lot, isn't it? A lot to deal with. So I hear you on that. I totally get it. But you know what? A little holiday home in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, oh, that sounds amazing. And I won't be sitting there going, I wonder when George's next appointment is. I wonder if he's done his physio. I wonder if, you know, and they're the sorts of things I thought I'd be thinking about for the rest of my life. And he'll fill it with some of the worry, I'm sure. But, you know, but at the moment, I'm just riding the wave of, he's going to be fine, you know. He's going to be fine.
Mm. Well, thank you, Nicola. And thank you for sharing the other side, because you know, we don't know as people until we explore or speak to people like yourself going through things different, how lucky maybe I am, or how now you've got this new leash of, I don't know, mindset, new leash of understanding in terms of moving forward and where you can be and where George can be. And I just think George is absolutely lovely anyway. So I just want to say, from Tony the Communication Doctor and Nicola Johnson, it's been great having you on the show today, but adios.
Thank you.
One of my takeaways from this show is that Nicola is incredibly strong, has an incredible inner strength, and having to go through some of the challenges when you have a son who has cystic fibrosis, where you're constantly having to check the physio, the next appointment, it takes a lot of strength to be optimistic and to have that self-belief. And I feel like her self-belief and her strength has carried her through this experience, which has allowed her now to be the mother that she is, and to now see that her son can live further, and then basically that she now can see the light and start to plan her life moving forward. So one of my takeaways is just strength. Being strong internally, mentally, and believing in the power of optimism and the power that things can change is a starting point. And I feel a lot can be learned from Nicola's strength. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. If you would like to learn more, please visit our website at communicationdoctor.co.uk. And to listen to more real stories, don't forget to subscribe.